Chapter 48, The Man in the Pit. Since my arrival 3 months earlier, my life had been predominantly one of travel, including pilgrimage, sightseeing, lecturing, and meeting people of many different kinds, from the Dalai Lama to illiterate villagers and convicted criminals. In other words, I'd been living very much on the first of the three levels recognized by Tibetan Buddhists, the level of the outer life, and comparatively little on the second level, that of the inner life of reflection and meditation. As for my secret life, the life I led on the third level, this had continued, as usual, to look after itself in its own mysterious way, without having direct contact with the two other levels. Once, while I was in Kalimpong, however, it broke through into those levels, and I had an experience that had no connection with anything I'd been doing or thinking the previous day. The experience happened at the Vihara, and though of a different kind from the one that had befallen me in Glasgow the previous year, it was hardly less intense and no less memorable. One night I awoke to find the whole room filled with light. Between my bed and the mattress on which Terry lay sleeping, there was a deep pit, and in the pit there was a man standing. His hands were joined in supplication, and he was looking upwards with a piteous, imploring expression, as if begging to be delivered out of the pit. It was Jivaka, the English doctor, who, then bearded and pipe-smoking, had turned up at the Vihara one morning in 1958 with one of the oddest requests I had ever received, that I should teach him how to read people's thoughts and how to see what was happening at a distance. He had been directed to me by Dada Rinpoche, whom he had met in Bodh Gaya, and who had assured him that the English monk who lived in Kalimpong was the best person to help him in this connection. The Rinpoche had worn a skirt, he added, laughing uproariously at the recollection, as if the idea of a man wearing a skirt was the funniest thing in the world. In view of his own history, this was ironic. He was, in fact, a woman. Born in 1915, he had been orphaned at an early age, had been brought up by two maiden aunts, had gone to Oxford, and between 1945 and 1948 had undergone a series of operations that had given him the outward appearance, at least, of a man, thus enabling him to pass as such. He had then qualified as a doctor, until recently had worked as a ship's doctor on a British liner, resigning only when the discovery of his change of sex by a reporter had led to its extensive coverage in the press. All this I learned from the newspaper cutting which, within minutes of his arrival at the Vihara, he produced from his wallet and silently handed to me. Later he told me that he had been greatly impressed by the fact that I had read it without turning a hair, as he put it, as well as by the readiness with which I agreed to his staying at the Vihara. He stayed for more than a year, studying the Dharma, learning to meditate, though not how to read people's thoughts or how to see what was happening at a distance, and writing his autobiography. To make it difficult for the press to track him down, he shaved off his beard, and I gave him the name of Jivaka, after the Buddha's personal physician. The fact that he was the first female-to-male transsexual to have modern surgery and hormone treatment was not the most interesting thing about the Vihara's new inmate, at least as far as I was concerned. He was also a disciple of the notorious Lobsang Rampa, author of the best-selling The Third Eye, who was not a Tibetan Lama at all, but a plumber from Plympton with a vivid imagination and a racy style. A few weeks after his arrival at the Vihara, Jivaka confided to me, with a solemn air, that Lobsang Rampa had initiated him into the secret order of the Potala, and invested him with its robe and girdle. There are only 13 members of the order, he had told him, including the Dalai Lama. And any Tibetan who saw him wearing the robe, even the highest dignitaries, would immediately prostrate himself before him. He had worn the robe when he went to see Dada Rinpoche, he added, But strange to say, the Rinpoche had not prostrated himself. Perhaps he was a low-ranking lama who had not heard of the order. Naturally, I wanted to know if he had brought the robe with him. He had brought it, and not only showed it to me, but demonstrated how it was to be worn, wrapping it round himself in the most extraordinary fashion and tying it with what appeared to be a length of dressing gown cord. "But Jivaka, it's an ordinary Burmese monk's robe," I exclaimed. "No, it's not," he retorted angrily. "It's the robe of the secret order of the Potala." Fortunately, I had just such a monk's robe in my cupboard. It was of the same yellowish-brown colour as the one Jivaka was wearing, consisted of the same number of patches, and bore in one corner the same manufacturer's label, in Burmese script. Jivaka was dumbfounded by the discovery. Even so, I had a hard time convincing him that Lobsang Rampo was not, as he claimed, a lama who had spent many years in Lhasa and had been initiated into the deepest mysteries of Tibetan Buddhism, and that the secret order of the Potala existed only in his fertile imagination. Eventually, however, I did convince him, whereupon he wrote to Rampa, who was then living in Ireland in a house bought for him by Jivaka, a letter of indignant remonstrance. To this, the supposed lama only replied that, evidently, some evil person had been undermining his faith. Jivaka's faith in his erstwhile master was indeed undermined, but not his faith in his own high spiritual destiny, a faith that had enabled him to regard membership of the secret order of the Potala as being no more than his due. "I know that I am a teacher with a capital T," he once told me. I had responded by saying that in that case he ought to have something to teach. It was this remark that led to his spending so much of his time studying the Dharma. Besides being spiritually ambitious, he was headstrong, willful, and by his own admission a great believer in the fait accompli. He could also be high-handed in his dealings with people. While I was away on one of my preaching tours, he took it upon himself to chastise one of the younger inmates of the Vihara with a slipper, a terrible indignity by local standards. I therefore made arrangements soon afterwards for him to continue his studies at Sarnath. There he quickly got himself ordained as a Theravadin novice, though without revealing to Sangharasana and the other monks his true sexual identity. Later, he spent 5 months at a monastery in Ladakh, where he became a novice in the Tibetan monastic tradition and started calling himself Lobsang Jivaka. He died suddenly in Dalhousie in 1962. This, then, was the unfortunate being whom I saw standing in the pit, his hands joined in supplication and clearly wanting to be delivered. I felt an intense desire to deliver him, and was wondering how this was to be done, when I suddenly remembered an incident that had occurred in the course of my connection with Jamyang Khyentse Rinpoche, whom I regarded as my principal teacher, or root lama, as a Tibetan Buddhist would have said. I had met the Rinpoche in 1957, shortly after his arrival from Tibet, where he was widely regarded as one of the very greatest of living lamas. We met in the bungalow I had once occupied as the guest of Prince Latakin of Burma, the son-in-law of the exiled King Tibor. He was then about 60, and though he wore the usual maroon robes, he at once struck me as being more like a Burmese Mahathera, or great elder, than a Tibetan incarnate lama. A few months later, having seen more of him, I asked Jamyang Khyentse, through Khyentse Rinpoche, for the Manjugosha Abhisheka, or consecration, which he gave me on the 24th of October 1957, together with the consecrations of Avalokiteshvara, Vajrapani, and Green Tara. The ceremony took place in Darjeeling, in the presence of Jamyang Khyentse's youthful Dakini, the Maharani of Sikkim, Khyentse Rinpoche, and a few other friends. Partly because it was in Tibetan, and partly because I was unwell at the time, as was Jemmy Nkensi. He died in 1959. I remembered little of what happened that morning. I did, however, remember offering to Jemmy Nkensi a mandala, or symbolic representation of the universe, and noticing with what reverence a disciple offered him the pointed red pandit cap, which he donned at certain key points in the ceremony. Above all, I remembered the rapt, beatific expression with which he looked up as he was invoking Manjugosha and the other bodhisattvas, as if he actually saw their diaphanous, rainbow-like forms floating in the air before him. He subsequently commissioned a tanka depicting Manjugosha and the three other bodhisattvas, together with the 19 great teachers who were his main spiritual ancestors, and whose different sectarian lineages he united in his own person. When I next visited Gangtok, where he was then staying, he handed me this tanka, at the same time explaining that in conferring the Abhishekas, he had transmitted to me the essence of all the teachings of all the gurus depicted therein. It was on the occasion of another visit to Gangtok, where Jemmy Nkensi was now settled, that there had taken place the incident which I suddenly remembered when I saw Jivaka standing in the pit. The Rinpoche's quarters were on the upper floor of the magnificent building that was the Royal Chapel. On my arrival there, I was asked to wait. I waited for about half an hour. On his emerging from an inner room, my venerable teacher apologized for having kept me waiting for so long, saying that a Lama friend of his had recently died, and in order to help him, he had been reciting the 100-syllable mantra of Vajrasattva, the diamond being who delivers from hell. No sooner did I remember these words than I knew what I had to do to help Jivaka. I started reciting the mantra. As I did so, I saw the letters of the mantra coming out of my mouth one after another and forming a chain or garland that went down into the pit and came up out of it in a continuous circular motion. On seeing the garland, Jivaka caught hold of the letters as they ascended and with their help hauled himself out of the pit and disappeared. At that instant the room was plunged into darkness, and in the distance I heard the horn of the jogi, the collector of the souls of the dead. I looked at my watch. It was 2 o'clock in the morning.